Ready to dive in? Welcome to Adventures in Truth Podcast. Every episode, we explore, expand, and evolve our understanding of the truths we encounter and experience in our human quest for clarity and exponential growth. And now welcome your hosts, Dr. Jeffrey Smith and Jim Case. Welcome to Adventures in Truth Podcast.
Good evening, everybody. This is Jim Case coming at you here with my good friend Jeff. And as Jeffrey and I were sitting here chatting back and forth and looking at some of the amazing technology that he has on hand here, we kind of landed on talking about the idea and concept and reality of stories in our lives. And for me and in my work, it's a significant, and I think too with I'm sure with you too, Jeff.
It is.
It's a significant aspect to the work, because the amount of energy and focus and time and creativity that people put into their story adds a lot of interference and and resistance and challenge to helping people get to what it is that they're wanting to transform, to get to what it is they're wanting to change, because they're so invested in what they have told themselves about the story. I'll share a quick example. I was working with I got a call from my client yesterday, who was going through a really challenging time in his marriage. They've been married for decades, and it's not in a good place, and he's struggling to deal with that, but is working toward that. But the point of the call was that he had this desire to really try to connect with his wife in a heart experience, and to have a conversation about the state of the state, mm-hmm. from a completely loving place with her, because that's not the space that she seems to be coming from. She's sort of done and over it, and you know. And it's challenged, but the point of getting to the story is that as he's talking to me, he's sharing with me the process of how they got together and how important it was and how significant he felt this relationship was in his life, and that this person was going to be the person who was going to be able to bring together his desire, and that together they were going to create this amazing family and this amazing life and this amazing experience, and I had to stop and say I'm a little confused, because at the beginning of the marriage, he cheated multiple times because he was afraid, because he didn't know if he was ready for the commitment. I mean, there was any number of reasons that he did it. And interestingly enough, he double-edged sworded himself, because the double-edged sword was he had had the experience of doing that and was feeling shame about it, because for the intervening 20-some-odd years, she's used that against him at every opportunity. And still, 20-some-odd years later, is still harboring some form of that, right? And he's feeding me the story that this was a powerful, amazing relationship that was going to create powerful, amazing things. And I said, that makes no sense. How do you have those two things operating at the exact same time? If that was the case, why would you be sleeping around? It doesn't seem like they go together. Now, maybe you were afraid of that thing you thought you were going to create, but to me, there was a complete disconnect, that he'd been telling himself this story about this wonderful relationship that didn't exist and still hasn't existed and still doesn't exist. and that his passion for that relationship was in such a place But the reality was, when in the moment of that experience, that wasn't the case at all. He was not terribly interested in the commitment. He was more interested in sleeping with other women than he was with his wife. And he was cheating before they got married, and he cheated after they got married, and she caught him. So it was kind of an interesting dynamic. But the point being that here we are 30 years later, and he's still telling himself the same story.
Which is what?
Which is, this relationship was about, for him, was about this woman that was going to create this powerful thing and this powerful dynamic with these people. And I said, well, give yourself credit for something, in that your focus, your desire in this relationship was to create a family, was to build this energy that you have been congruent with and consistent about since the day I met you, that your kids and your family and that whole unit are significant and hugely important to you. And that's never wavered. You never told a different story about that. That's always been the case. I said, but what if what you were feeling was this woman could provide this atmosphere that you wanted to create, this family, could provide that ability to do that, and you've done that. And now it's done. And it doesn't have to be anymore. Because he wants to hold on to the story of how important the relationship is. Except there's no relationship. The relationship is, you know, her version is, you got to change 180 degrees. And his version is, well, what does that look like? And she says, I don't know. And you go, wait, you got to, excuse me. So I just, it's such an interesting dynamic how we tell ourselves stories over time. And the stories get richer and prettier and deeper and more interesting and more complex. But we don't tend to stop to look at what was really going on, what really happened, or what was the motivation for creating that story. You know, and when you think that story got created and the story got perpetuated, even though things were not going in a useful pattern, and I see that a lot with people. This is not going in the right direction.
I'm tracking with you. I love it.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, keep going with it.
I felt like it was... we're not moving in the right direction. So,
well, maybe it would be helpful to define story a little bit more.
So, what I call story is, I mean, it's very, actually quite literal. It's, there, we weave a tapestry of beliefs together in a way that presents whatever ultimate experience or ultimate feeling or ultimate end result that we're looking for. We can weave that however we want to.
Mm-hmm.
We can create that in whatever way we want to. So I'm using the dynamic of what my client is going through, because the problem with the stories is that they become so entrenched in all of the rest of our belief system somehow, that over time, I don't know if I... You and I talked about the kid and the red ball before. Haven't we had that somewhere along the way?
I have forgotten if we did.
Kids playing in the front yard, a little kid playing with a red ball in the front yard. He throws the ball in the air, and the ball bounces out into the street, and the kid runs out to get the ball and gets hit by a car.
Yeah.
And so what happens over the course of that kid's existence and over time, 20 years later, you run into that now man who is afraid of the color red,
mm-hmm.
who has associated with play with pain,
right.
who has extrapolated on that experience in a way that is so far removed from anything that occurred in the situation, because the emotional trauma has impacted in a way that fight or flight mechanism, that ego part of the part that's trying to keep the body on the planet, is saying, no, you can't, we have to build a framework, we have to build a belief system, we have to build a structure and a story to make sure you stay safe. So, red balls, cars, playing, all those things are not safe because they cause pain.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to figure out how to ameliorate that pain. So the ego begins to take all the evidence and build more evidence into our lives as we go through the experience of growing up. That young person could have had another associative experience in school. You
right.
know, that the bully used to wear a red T-shirt. So now, not only is fun factored into my pain, now there's another example of how something causes me pain, and it's red. And, you know, and this can go on and on. He can't get a driver's license because he's terrified that he's going to crash a car. Has no logical reason for it, but builds a story about, well, you know, Mom told me when I was young and I got hit by a car, and I think that's probably why I do that. So now Mom has told me a story that I believe about why I feel this way. So now I'm agreeing that I believe that I feel this way. And it just perpetuates and perpetuates and perpetuates. And I think that I find, and I'm sure I would be surprised if you didn't, that the largest part of the work is getting all that crap out of the way so you can get to the organic part of the person, but how do you feel? What's your experience? What's your process? And many times they don't have an answer for that question. It takes a bulk of the time to get them refocused into their own emotional guidance system, to get them realigned into being able to sift through the crap that's spinning around in here, to be able to differentiate between, is this my thought or is just this a thought?
Right.
You know, is this someone else's story or is this what I truly believe? Is this an inherited thing? I've heard this so many times, so I believe it's true. You know, and so that carries on. So that the significance of the stories is the more that we can separate from the stories, the easier and more quickly we're able to transform our experience. Because all of the stories in my experience, even the good ones, are built on resistance. They're built on a foundation that is flawed and not real.
Right.
So you could make a good story that sounds good, like I wanted to get married because I thought this woman was the most amazing person I'd ever met and she was going to help change my life, to going out and sleeping around with anybody you could sleep with, the two don't go together. Mm-hmm. They're not congruent. And then to top all that off, the story, this is, and the complexity of it, so now there is a denial of the why you did it to begin with, which is just a simple answer, which is because I wanted to. It could have been driven by insecurity. It could have been driven by a number of things. But the reality is, you did it. You were conscious. You did it. You made the choice to do it. And not only did you make the choice to do it once, you made the choice to do it multiple times. So it's not as though you were not completely aware of what you were doing. So it makes it very difficult to have this story about this powerful person and this story about the person who doesn't acknowledge the power, who has no relationship to that powerful person. They don't. Those two energies don't combine. And you've taken this situation, which you don't acknowledge, and you've now created a shameful experience out of this because the religious aspect of you has decided that God sees you as unworthy because you've done this, so now you carry this bucket of shame. So the way it plays out is that over the course of the marriage or the relationship, this individual is now the whipping post.
Mm-hmm.
On a regular basis.
Sure.
Of how bad and unworthy and not right and just this constant flood of stuff that he's trying to fix in himself, but it doesn't exist. So he's like, you know, it's like running like a dog trying to chase his tail, trying to find, the story is so powerful that he's spending all of his energy trying to find things that don't exist because he hasn't stopped long enough to go, but is that me? Is that mine?
Right.
Is that what I do or is that not what I do? You know, where the conversation becomes, I keep trying to make this right. I want to fix this money thing. I have a money problem. I'm like, really? Tell me about your money problem. Well, I don't pay bills on time and I don't do this right and I don't do that right. And I said, and did that start yesterday? Well, no. I said, then apparently it's not a problem. Because you've been doing it for a long time. And apparently it hasn't been a problem. But now it's a problem because someone else has told you it's a problem. and you're believing it because you're feeling shame because, it's just this convoluted collection of nonsense that doesn't serve, in the end, it doesn't serve our ability to move forward. So do you have any thoughts on that now that I've just...
One or two.
Like, ran off at the mouth.
No, it was good. That was good. For me, where story starts is to try to differentiate the difference between people's experience and then the modification of that experience into a narrative that we would call story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, for me, story is an embellishment. It's either an exaggeration, it's a distortion of experience, generally over time, and it's unproductive. Stories generally aren't fairy tale, happy ending type stories.
Right, exactly.
Generally.
Yeah.
So as an example of a conversation I was having earlier today, where this person was telling me that their experience was in a social gathering where this person said that the daughters of this person that they were dating were girly girls and that was going to be a challenge. And the guy's girlfriend didn't actually hear that exchange of information. What the guy's girlfriend heard was from the woman in the conversation that the boyfriend said the daughters were girly girls and that was going to be a challenge in the relationship. So that was the pure experience. That part alone was the pure experience. And then in a discussion between the girlfriend and the boyfriend about that experience, there were embellishments that got added to the point where the boyfriend allegedly never has anything positive to say about the girlfriend. Now, that part was all embellished. That part was all added. Because, first of all, the girlfriend wasn't at that conversation and didn't actually have that experience to know whether or not the boyfriend ever says anything positive about the relationship or not, because how could you, right? Mm-hmm. So that part's just added in. The girlfriend could say, I have never heard you say anything positive about our relationship, but to make a blanket statement, you never have anything positive to say about the relationship, that's the story.
Mm-hmm.
That came from the experience of the conversation between two other people that got relayed back to her of your girls are girly girls and that's going to be a challenge. Okay, well, that doesn't mean a challenge is a bad thing. It just means it's a challenge. So
you never don't even know what that's, how that's referenced.
Uh-huh.
You know?
So in working with this boyfriend and girlfriend, the point was to help them see what part was experience, real experience, it really freaking did happen, versus the part that got added to that became the story, that after you tell it, we give up the actual experience part and we stick with the story. And that becomes our truth. And it's not truth. It's a grand distortion of truth. And doggone it, we like bulldogs sink our teeth into those stories. Like we depend on them. We absolutely depend on them.
Microcosm, macrocosm. I mean, we in our society now are seeing that exact thing on a daily basis, where people are being fed stories on a mass scale that are completely not true. I had a gal the other day, yesterday, that I was driving, who had just come back, literally got off the plane from Israel. And she'd been there for 2 weeks. And I said, oh, how was it? And she said, absolutely amazing. And I said, really? So did you have any experience of the strife that's apparently going on there, and all of this, you know, I mean, did you hear bombs going off? Was it like, was it a horrible kind of thing? And she said, not even once. I said, interesting. She said, yeah, the people were lovely. I had a, you know, they were just delightful people, and the country is amazing, and they have, you know, she said, of course the culture is different, and there's a little bit of this different, and, you know, we talked about how women present themselves in the culture, and, you know, she said, yeah, there are certain places I can't go, and was told don't go. Not because I necessarily would be unsafe, but because it would cause too much strife, because in certain communities, women dress in a certain way, mm-hmm. and if you're willing to go along and do that, then you can engage, and that's fine. But we talked for, you know, easily 20 minutes, and it was absolutely amazing to me that she spent over 2 weeks in this place that is supposedly, you know, just this crazy place to be, and that she didn't have any of that at all. Never saw it, never experienced it, never touched it, nothing.
She didn't get into that story.
Yeah.
Because had she gone there with that story, I'm pretty sure it would have showed up for her.
More than likely.
Which is a really important part of our message, is that your story will show up for you. Mm-hmm. It's like it's honor bound. And that would be part of the law of attraction and part of this thing called manifesting. The other thoughts I have about this topic are that it may be the single thing that we have control over.
Mm.
And we are, as a species, control freaks. We have four lucky charms. We have a four-leaf clover. We have a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, leprechauns, rabbit's feet. These things that baseball players do before they get up to bat, they do that thing as if
themselves.
God is rooting for the batter and not the pitcher. That always kind of like blew my mind. What if the pitcher was doing the same thing at the same time, right? You
know? Yeah, that always kind of makes me scratch my head.
So
thank Jesus for this. Jesus wasn't here. Unless you're talking about Jesus, which was catcher. Jesus wasn't here. He was... Sorry, go ahead.
So I share with folks oftentimes that we really go out of our way to try to control things or create this illusion of control. First of all, as if it's necessary. Like, we can't just trust that what shows up for us is what we need to be experiencing, and maybe we planned it, if you can kind of get into any of that sort of thinking, whatever. But what we can control is the meaning that we assign to what we experience.
Yeah.
And if we get really good at taking responsibility for assigning only the meaning that is helpful for us, that we can learn from and grow through, then you kind of learn to let go of these other things that you once were trying to control. I'm the only one who can write my story.
Yeah.
I oftentimes hear people say things like, you made me feel, you made me think, you blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, that's somebody who's given their pen to somebody else and let them start writing their story. Or all the people that come in and they tell me this is who they are because this is what their parents told them. You'll never amount to anything. That's a classic one. Well, that was a parent writing the kid's story that mm-hmm. the kid is still telling themselves and still living up, and guess what, still showing up in their life. And I said, you know what? What if we worked on helping you rewrite that story? And it's like, I've got a magic eraser. It's called EMDR and some of these other protocols and techniques and things. But it's fascinating to me how people want to hang on to their stories. There's this fear of, who would I be without my story? I've been a victim for so long. I don't know what it would be like to be an observer and not a victim.
Yeah.
Or not go from victim to perpetrator and then just play that dance back and forth all the time.
At least I have some meaning. If I have a story, I have meaning. I have significance. I guess my significance is I'm meant to be a fuck-up for my experience, because everybody told me that.
Right.
You know? But it... Yeah, even in my own, you're talking about the responsibility piece of, that I think is so important. You know, I what happens for me now is I get tired of hearing myself talk. When I'm aware that I'm in story, I get tired of my voice.
Cool.
I'm like, I don't want to, you know, I'll have a conversation with a friend and I'll be talking about what's going on. And not 5 minutes into the conversation, I'm so over the sound of my voice and I'm just like, I'm sorry, I feel like I have diarrhea of the mouth. And they're like, what are you talking about? You're fine. But I've heard the damn thing in my head for, you know, days at a time, that it's like, I'm just so done with this, you know? The good news is it stops me from, it's a way of curtailing a portion of it, you know, in that I'm not constantly trying to tell the same story. I mean, I may be doing it in here, but I'm not trying to do it out here, you know, and realizing that when I'm at that tire's like, okay, so I've apparently got a loop going. I've gotta take a minute here and figure out why I'm perpetuating this loop, and how can I find a more positive framework to hold it in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I may get there. You know, I may get to a point where I can see the shift, and then I can shift. But sometimes some of them are, they're pretty ground in there. You know, as I think about the stuff that I have been calling my midlife crisis, you know, that it doesn't appear that there's a root. And because there doesn't appear to be a root, then I have to stop and go, then how real is it? You know, how much of this is fabrication? And because for me, the and I use this with clients all the time, is the foundational place is inventory for me. So if I'm going there, if my mind is in that, you know, in the spin cycle, then the first thing I do is inventory. I stop and go, show me what's wrong with my life right now.
Mm-hmm.
I have an amazing relationship. I live in a beautiful house. I'm in one of the most beautiful cities in the country. I'm able to pay my bills. I eat every day. I have my health. I sleep well at night. Where's the problem? And then you go, the mind can't answer that question.
Right.
And you go, then what's the problem? Well, there apparently isn't one. Well, then what's all that shit about? What is that story? Why is that story want to keep running? And that's what I say when there's no root. And you go, so if everything is good and this is going on at the same time, then for most, it's they have to be married, because the story is, it's obviously must be true, because it feels true, it sounds true, so it must be true. So they bring it over here and they slap it in the middle of their world, and then they really do screw up their world. Because now it's become congruent in their experience. It's become one and the same thing. So all the things that were supposedly okay are now no longer okay, because this has now come over here and you've overlaid that energy. So it can be. And I think this is something that I find, that I find a lot with clients, is that's the challenging part of transformation. That's the challenging part of consciousness, is being conscious, is being aware that those things go on simultaneously, and it's where you put your attention that makes the difference. So your mind is already tapped into mind, thought. Thought is there, it's everywhere, it's all over the place. And, you know, we have no control over where thought is, and the fact that thought is going at all, the thought energy is happening constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on the state of our alignment, depending on the state of the condition of our alignment, sometimes it's louder, sometimes it's softer. But it's different than the voice that is the voice that's been with you forever.
Right.
You know, that voice, you know, the voice that you can identify that has never changed in your whole life. It's the same voice you've heard forever. That, to me, is your connected voice. That's your highest self. That's,
mm-hmm.
Then there's the noise, which is the ego mind that is always looking for a problem, looking for a solution, looking for something, looking for attention, looking for whatever, whatever, whatever. But the duality of it is quite extraordinary, because that can go on and you can still be over here and be okay. And you can, but it's disconcerting in the process of expansion because it's there, it's stimulated for a reason. But is the reason simply because in your level of sensitivity, you're just aware that there's stuff in my energy system and thoughts are flying around all the time. And I walked by somebody who, I drove past somebody who, I walked into the restroom after somebody who had some major shit going on in their energy space.
Right.
And I had a little bit of it in mind. So right. It stimulated. And then my mind's going. And you could spend a lot of time making story up about that. Or you can go, oh, that's really not very pleasant. I think I'd rather go over here and put my attention over here to the inventory where I, you know, things are okay. And this doesn't feel very good. I think it's important to get to a place where you can see the two, where you can see the duality, because mm-hmm. it's at that juncture, I think, that you come into the strongest place of personal power, because you're able to see it and acknowledge it for what it is without having to react to it or attend to it necessarily. That if you're in that aligned place, then the story, if it's of value, will find a way through your aligned state to inspire you to something that will bring you clarity about that. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah.
But when you do, it's sort of like Law of Attraction talks about that there's a very distinct difference between the energy of a problem and the energy of a solution.
Right.
And the energy of a problem is you'll never find solution if your focus is on the problem.
Right.
Same idea. If you put your attention to the noise, then you're going to get more noise. If you put your attention where there's not noise, then if this noise is important, then it can inform this state because it's
right.
important.
Right.
If it can't inform the state, then it's of no value and it doesn't have any significance. That's a hard thing for people to let go of.
Yeah. What I heard you say is we can get comfortable in that energy of our story and stay there, and we will stay there. Mm-hmm. And that story will just perpetuate and perpetuate, and a decade or two or three or a lifetime will go by, and that's your story. Mm-hmm. That's the energy state. That's the concern that I have about people that have bad info in their stories. Yeah. And that it actually doesn't take that much to begin to change your story. Mm-hmm. Even smiling as you tell your story will raise the frequency just enough that you might tell it just a little bit differently this time, and then just a little bit differently next time,
yeah.
and a little bit differently the time after that. Before you know it, you're like, really? That's the story I used to be telling myself?
Do you find that, I'm curious because it's something that at least from the perspective that I approach this stuff from, that there is inherent always in the story, there's always a flaw.
Of course.
There's always an incongruence mm-hmm. in the story.
Mm-hmm. I call it a distortion of truth.
Distortion of mm-hmm. truth is a good way to say it. And that when that's presented, that's the beginning of clarity.
Yep.
Because
when you're willing to look at that part.
Right, because they can't when you like how can you tell me that this was the most powerful relationship you've ever had while you're sleeping with other people at the same time. The two stories don't match. So somewhere, there's a lie in the middle of there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
What's the lie? What's, you know, and I say lie, I don't particularly like the word, but it's still real to the fact that the lie is to yourself.
Well, to me, a lie is anything less than the truth, which would go back to a distortion of truth.
Distortion of truth. Mm-hmm.
It could be a big lie or a little lie, but anything
is
less than the truth.
Yeah. I like the choice of the word distortion, because the distortion idea, for me, you know, we talk about language a lot, mm-hmm. and distortion speaks to energy.
It does. That's a
frequency. Where lie speaks to subjective judgment,
mm-hmm.
And I think that the idea of that anomaly,
mm-hmm.
you can look at energetically, you can see. Here's the energy flow. Here's the energy flow.
And here's the energy. What people do when they're doing a lie detector, right? It's a classic thing, polygraph or whatever they call that.
Yeah.
you have to be a sociopath in order to override the mechanisms of heart rate and galvanic skin temperature and perspiration and all these other things. For me, the fun work in helping people rewrite their stories begins when they are willing to look at keywords in their use of telling a story. And the easy ones to pick up are the absolutes. Very few things in life you could put in that category. So it doesn't mean that absolutely, every time you use an absolute, it's a distortion of truth. But there's probably a really high likelihood that there's something going on there. And just asking people to say, is that really true that that never happens? Or he always does that? And what if you just changed the never or always to most of the time or very rarely? Feel that. Mm-hmm. Say it again and feel that. And does that feel different? And it'll completely feel different to the one who's being accused.
Oh, yeah.
Now we have truth taking place. And now we can actually move somewhere in that conversation and in that story. So when we finally get to at least closer to the truth, I don't need people to say, it happens 97.3 times, right? That's not the idea. But if you can get from always or never to rarely or most of the time, or even most often, or something like that, we can work with that. Yeah. Now that's a workable story. And even if it isn't a story that two people are trying to hash out between themselves, if it's just a story within an individual I'm working with, their absolutes come out real easy. And I'm just, okay, pay attention to your absolutes. And then say it again more truthfully, or as truthfully as you can possibly bear.
Mm.
And see what that feels like. And it feels different. It feels, I can work with that. I can live with that.
Mm.
The story that you're coming back to with the gentleman who wanted to believe his story with this person was the best opportunity to have this most amazing experience actually could be a true story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's his own fear of having that experience that kept him from having that experience. Like some other story that's connected to that, like I don't deserve it, I'm not ready for it, something, who knows?
Right.
And that would be where I would go to try
and that
to chase
was part
after
of,
that.
That was part of the deal was spend some time sitting in the experience of when you went there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're, again, one story, another story. There's a huge gap between these stories. So you got to go back to the source of the event and just, as best you can. I don't need you to make up more story. I just want you to feel your way into it and
right.
feel when that guy stepped out, what was he? Did he have any thoughts about it? Did he care?
Mm-hmm.
Was he having anything other than I want this immediate satisfaction? Or was it a fear-driven response? You know, it's tough, you know, especially when you're dealing with story, that's a little dicey because nobody has good memory for yesterday, let alone 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And especially memory that is already clouded by either trauma or intense emotion or, you know, an intense experience.
Sure.
Because the focus is on the intensity of the experience, not on what was actually taking place in the event. You know, and so to me that becomes a little more challenging. But I still think that there's, to go there and just be in the space of that so that you can feel your way into the reality of where you were. It's not to say that you weren't, you know, you got caught, you made a decision, you chose to go forward in the marriage, you chose to change your approach and change your ways about it because the idea of family was that significant to you that you wanted this to work.
Mm-hmm.
But in his own language, he would lead off with, I didn't really want to get married. He actually, that statement had been said multiple times in different context, in other sessions where, you know, yeah, we were getting married and I didn't really want to get married and I was doing it because blah, 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 you know, so there's other evidence that says, yeah, no, Mm-hmm. there's more to this picture than you're presenting, than you're letting yourself know. Because if you can be the bad guy, then her behavior gets excused. You get to figure out what's wrong with this picture and fix it, and you can have your happily ever after. But that isn't going to happen, and you know that's not going to happen, because what's going to get you to the happily ever after is you subjugating everything you believe and know to everything she believes and knows. And if you go there, then what? Because this dynamic that you wanted to create with your kids, and the, you know, you've done an amazing job creating this environment for your kids to thrive. So now that this relationship is deteriorated to the point it is it in your best interest to continue that delusion? And that illusion, because now what they're learning is dysfunction. Mm-hmm. Is that what you want them to learn? Or do you want them to learn that adults come to places where it's time to think about other options, regardless of religious affiliation? Because that's a large part of what drives some of it. And I know for him, too, is, you know, as a Christian, we get through it. I'm like, yeah, good luck with that.
Onward, Christian soldiers, marching off to war.
We can all recite it. We can all recite that one. But yeah, I more and more am amazed at how story is being used, and how prolific it's become in our culture. Because now it's not just about, you know, when I wrote Fear is a Choice, that was only a little over, only 2 years ago. That was still coming from the idea that and understanding how fear is manipulated and used in our culture. But with the changes that have occurred in the culture since then, it's now gone beyond just manipulating fear to manipulating story and content to create an outcome and a belief and a feeling in people that keeps the storyline going. You know, I another person I was writing with earlier today worked on is it Carl DeMaio? Is that the guy's name here in town? One of the politicians? I think it is. Anyway, he worked on a number of campaigns in the area, and he said categorically, the system will never change because politicians don't want resolution. Because if they have resolution, they have no talking points to get elected.
Right. Yeah.
And he said, and that's, if there's anything that I've learned in doing this job and being in the political system, it's recognizing that the politicians will not resolve anything because they can't. Because if they do, they don't have anything to stand up in front of people and say, I'm for this, right, and I'll make sure this happens.
Exactly.
And I thought, wow, if that's not just the most gross manipulation of story, I don't know what is. Because it's, they have to come up with a continuing storyline to make it make sense. You know, I tend to stay away from getting into much on Facebook, you know, with regard to politics, and because it gets really crazy ugly. And I had an experience the other day that I could not say something. I couldn't leave it alone. And that was it had happened days before, but there was a story that our president had commented about the Florida shootings, that the solution was to arm the teachers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm familiar with that.
I thought I was just going to come unglued. I couldn't. It's so far afield of anything rational to me. And so I put this post up and I said, I'm sorry, I must have been out of the loop, but I can't believe that. How did I say this? Because it was pretty straightforward. It was, our president is such a fucking idiot that he would say the teacher should be armed. And I said, and if you think that that's useful, then unfriend me and block me. Because if you believe that, you're as big a fucking idiot as he is. So, if you know, for me, I don't have a huge, you know, those things don't, I don't pay attention to a lot of that because it's not my world. It's not, you know, it's, meaning it's not, it's just story. It's mm-hmm. just somebody else's crap and drama that I really care to be involved in. But the idea that the second part of the thing was, for me, was if a weapon has the words automatic or assault in the description or the title, they don't belong in anybody's hands, except maybe the military, from my perspective. Nobody needs that. Not required, not necessary. You're like 22, you go out and play and shoot your gun, good. You got a pistol, you like mm-hmm. to go shoot beer cans, knock mm-hmm. yourself out. I don't have an issue with guns.
Right.
But that there is, but listening to this guy tell his story about what he's observed in politics and then seeing this whole thing unfold, more story, it's just more fodder and more nonsense. And then today, I guess Dick's Sporting Goods has removed all of those guns from their stores. We'll not sell them anymore.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty remarkable.
They're not going to be dicks anymore?
They're not going to be dicks anymore. Too funny. There's times when the story gets so, to me, that, and I don't know if you experience this like I do, but I there's much that I can ignore because it's not, it doesn't directly affect me, and when I say that, I don't mean from a responsibility perspective. I mean that whatever that story is not something I ascribe to, and it doesn't it's not going to serve anything for me to play counterpoint to the story, because there's already so many sides to the story that my 3 cents really doesn't make any difference.
Right,
and it's a waste of energy to try to put energy there, because it's just in a cesspool. It's like, you know, great, I'm going to throw a good apple in the middle of this cesspool and hope it's going to change the cesspool. It's not going to happen.
You feed the worms.
Yeah. It's like, sorry, you were getting ready to say something there.
We were chatting earlier that, for the most part, story, in the way we're talking about it, usually is more frowny face than happy face. I actually have a happy face story.
No.
And it still illustrates this idea, this concept of, I once had a story about pain. What made me think about this was when you were talking about the kid with the red ball, mm-hmm. and you talked about how fun became pain. What you didn't talk about was there was a whole story about pain. And that story... there's two thoughts that I have that I'd like to share. The first one is, my brother is a head football coach, and occasionally they make it to games where they're on ESPN, and he'll be interviewed either before, during, or after the game to give his commentary on how the team is doing and how the game is going. And he was chatting with me about his thoughts on how to do that and have it be entertaining and informational to the viewer. And he had a habit of saying, I think, were the first two words out of his mouth before he would say, I think this is how it's going, or I think the other team was more with whatever, whatever. And I said, what if you changed that up to say, so far our experience has been, we came here and the weather's too darn cold and we weren't prepared for it. And the point that I was asking him to consider was, most of the time when humans hear the word I think, they start to fade out, mm-hmm. because nobody really gives a shit what you think. They really don't, because people think such wide variety, you know, just, it's all over the place. Yeah. I mean, even, should I eat eggs? Should I not eat eggs? Is a glass of wine good for me every night? Is a glass of wine mean I'm an alcoholic every night? I mean, it's just... those two simple things alone we've been talking about for years, and will we ever get the right answer? So we really don't care what we think, right? That's not a good way to pull somebody in with the I think. Who the heck are you? Even if you are John Madden and he gets up there and says, I think, you know, football god, whatever, people tend to start pulling away and backing out. So I asked him just to start saying, our experience or my experience thus far is... and that pulls people in. So that takes me back to our conversation in the beginning when we started talking about our experience, mm-hmm. rather than our story. So story oftentimes will be, I think. Mm-hmm. Experience is just that. It'll be more of I feel, or even just the words, what I've experienced so far. So I really encourage people to make that shift in how they're communicating. Nobody can argue with your experience. Nobody.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nobody can tell me I'm not cold, I'm not hot, I didn't experience that, I didn't experience this. But as soon as I say I think this or I know that, man, you just open yourself up for did the glove fit with OJ and all that sort of thing, right?
Brilliant distinction. Yeah.
Thank you. So I had an experience. It just occurred to me a year ago today. I got out of the hospital after having been there for 27 days and going through 11 surgeries. And one of the surgeries I woke up from, and I had had a fasciotomy, and my arm was literally butchered. That's the best way I can describe it. When I gained consciousness and the bandages were being changed, I was able to take some pictures of my arm, and it, when I say gaping wounds, I'm talking 2 inches wide, and all the way to the bone deep on both sides of my arm to allow it to drain. And my hand, it was, there's no other way to describe it other than it looked like a butcher came in and just butchered my arm. That's the only way I can describe it. And I was aghast at that. That was my arm. I was on Dilaudid, fentanyl. So, and it still hurt. There wasn't a way to get that level of pain to like leave me. So that kind of set a high benchmark of, for me, what pain was. And little by little, day by day, I got used to that level of pain to where, okay, my story was, how the hell am I going to deal with that? How can I live with that? And little by little, I began to. And surgery after surgery after surgery, I wasn't aware of it at the time, but now looking back at it, it began to hurt less and less and less in terms of the recovery time afterward. I had my very most recent surgery was this past November, and it was, I walked into the surgery room, laid on the table, they put me under. An hour later, they woke me up. I walked back into the recovery room, stayed there for an hour or so, and then my girlfriend very kindly drove me home. Did you hear that, honey? I do say nice things about you in public. The fascinating thing to me about that experience was it was an incision. You can't see it if you're listening to this, but it was from the palm of my hand all the way up to my elbow on the inside. And also a line over here. So like, you know, a 12-inch long incision, fairly deep on both sides because they removed a skin graft and pulled the skin back together again and cleaned up some scar tissue. I had local anesthesia put into my arm, lidocaine I think it was, for a painkiller there. And they gave me a Percocet. And an hour later, I was supposed to take another Percocet. And it didn't hurt, so I didn't take the Percocet. 2 hours afterwards, I was supposed to be on Percocet like all day. I just freaking had, you know, surgery again. I never took any more painkillers after I left the hospital. Mm. Not any. You know, had the bottle, could have taken them. And I'm just thinking, and I was able to, you know, it had a bandage on it, but I'm able to like touch it. And I'm just freaking out in my mind. Why doesn't this hurt? It's supposed to hurt. Come on, Jeff, you have a story. Your arm is effed up, and it's, you went to the hospital. I really did have that experience, but yet I wasn't having pain, and it was really just messing with my head. And I thought, well, maybe I'm on so many painkillers. I don't know. What did they do? Maybe the anesthesia is still perking around in my head. So next day, same thing. I never to this day took any more pain meds, not ibuprofen, not aspirin, nothing after that. So somehow I rewrote my story about my relationship with pain to where I could tell you it is possible to go to the hospital, have your arm cut open wide, and have the little local injections and one Percocet, and you'll be fine. know, most people would say, you're freaking tripping, man. That's not possible. I said, well, it actually is, because that was my experience, and you cannot take it away from me. You cannot take that away. You could say, I don't believe you.
Yeah.
You could say, I don't think I could do it. But I had the opportunity to rewrite my story about pain.
Mm-hmm.
And I love it. If for nothing else, I went through all of that to get to that point, that was worth it for me. And I still don't know if I'm able to articulate it as profoundly as that impacted me. But it's really helped me understand how mind mm-hmm. and story can override what we're going through, for better or for worse. It works either way.
Yeah.
And for me, that was just, I'm getting a little emotional of just how awesome that opportunity was to experience that. And it was just a rewrite.
There was somebody, I'm trying to think who it was that said it. The definition of pain, is it 90%? 90% imagined?
Yeah.
10% real or something?
Yeah.
I wish I could remember the attribution or who it came from, because it was really, I want to say it was bald guy that died recently.
Oh, Wayne Dyer.
Wayne Dyer. I want to say that it came through him. But it was very, very powerful, that idea that you know, what we call pain
mm-hmm.
is actually largely fabrication and
sure. yeah.
only a small bit of real.
Let's push into that just a wee bit deeper. So, interestingly to me, the pain centers in the brain coalesce or coincide with the large muscle movement center of the brain, which are right next door to the emotional center of the brain.
Mm.
So emotional pain and physical pain, they're, hello, we live right, we're neighbors, we're right here. So they're virtually one and the same, and we can handle them in the same way. So if that's true for physical pain, it's got to also be true for emotional pain.
Yeah.
90% fabricated, 10% real.
That's amazing. I had a very similar experience when I went through my cancer treatment. I had anal cancer, and so they shot all the radiation in my crotch. And I was 2.5 weeks into treatment, and I was moving very slow. You know, I mean, I was moving like an 80-year-old man, you know, but I figured that was just the way it was. I mean, I was, you know, they were burning my burning my crotch with radiation. So it was, but I didn't associate it with pain. I just, you know, I mean, I would just be like, oh God, so I'm gonna be moving, and moving was slow. And so I had gone out to, this was when I was in Phoenix, and I went out on the patio, and my stepdaughter was there, and you know, I kind of came out, and it's like, and just trying to get comfortable, and you know, just trying to get settled in, and then I would get settled in, and I would just kind of be there. And she looked over at me, she said, "Did they give you pain medication?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "Did you take it?" I said, "No." "Well, why not?" "Well, because I'm uncomfortable, but I'm not in pain." She said, "Are you out of your mind?"
I'm like, "Yes, what are you talking about?" As a matter of
yeah,
fact.
She's like, "What?" I'm like, "What are you talking?" She's like, "They give you pain medicine because they know it hurts. This is not a good plan." You know,
damn it, Jim, stick to the story.
She's like, right? "Go take the pain medication."
The story is, you've got to take the pain meds. That's the story.
I'm like, "All right, fine, I'll go take the pain meds." Took the pain meds. Within 30 minutes, I was a completely different human being. Because I had no, what I realized was that I had no relation to that kind of pain.
Yeah.
So it doesn't transmit as
sure,
pain.
Sure, right.
Right? It just doesn't feel good. It's like, this is really yucky. Until you take the pain meds, and then you go, holy crap, I must have been in a lot of pain. You know? But But the funny part of it is that I don't think I stayed on it very long. It was long enough to realize that, okay, now I know what the difference is, whatever my body's going through. But part of that is I've got to figure out what to do with this burn,
mm-hmm.
you know, which finally they gave me burn cream like they do for, you know, burn ward patient, like the zinc stuff that they slather, and that made a huge difference. But it just, it's fascinating that I don't even know, you know, we make up stories about, or we create stories about, based on even not having firsthand experience. You've never had your arm dissected while you were living.
Right.
Right? So where would you have any relation to understanding that level of intensity,
mm-hmm.
you know, any more than I would have any idea how to understand that level of intensity. But even still, you know, as we were sharing earlier before we started, the Wellbutrin thing, you know, the same thing, that's it's so altering. where I'm going with that is that we don't have a clear idea of what our experience is of something, and then someone tells us this is what the experience is, so we believe them.
Right.
And by virtue of believing them, we've now created our own story about it.
Yeah.
And then we take a pill because the pill's supposed to make it better,
mm-hmm.
but it's making better the story, it's not making better necessarily the body.
Right, exactly.
So you feel better because you took a pill, because it's making you feel better, but it isn't really doing anything for the experience that's happening in the body. And then when you just be with the experience is what it is, like you experienced through mm-hmm. that. Yeah, no, this is not what I would prefer to feel, but it's what I'm feeling, you know.
I love the nurse's comment, because she, for the most part, said, "Are you out of your mind? You've got to feel the pain. You have to be like everybody else, and that hurts. We all know it, and you're not feeling it, so there's something wrong with you."
Really? Wow.
Stick to the damn script, Jim. Come on. Hospital, nurses, radiation, pain.
Which part are you missing?
You've got to be out of your mind.
Go back to school. Figure it out.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I am out of my mind, and I'm quite enjoying it. I'm out of my story.
Yeah.
Right?
Can we pause for a minute? I need to pee. Unless you want to sit here and talk to yourself for a minute.
All right, we are back. Having some fun tonight, talking about the concept of story and helping us be aware of our story, and then the parts that don't fit for us any longer, we outgrow them, we realize they're dysfunctional or they're keeping us stuck. We might want to shift our conversation a little bit and talk about the way out of our story, or how it is to grab an eraser and change certain parts about that. Yeah,
I was thinking it might be good to offer some ways to shift that.
I've found with most situations that awareness is the beginning step. Awareness and understanding then lead to the ability to scheme and plan, or be open to, or get the download, however it works. But simply awareness, the awareness of, oh, we're telling stories? Those are key words I could listen for to realize that I'm telling a story, and to be able to feel it. So what I ask people to do is to try to make it so simple to imagine that there are two states that we can be in.
Mm-hmm.
Content, and it doesn't take much to think about what that is,
mm-hmm.
and its opposite, discontent. And there are extreme experiences of those. Euphoria, rapture, elation, orgasm, or content, to despair, catatonia, rage, those sorts of things for discontent. But in either case, you have this thing, our bodysuit, mm-hmm. that we're wearing, that we're operating in, that can certainly give us clues as to which state we're in. So audience, dearly beloved people who are listening in podcast land, it's kind of a no-brainer to, if you don't know what state you're in, content or discontent, it's really easy. Look in the mirror. Are you smiling or are you frowning? Is your heart beating fast or slow? Is your airway open or closed? Do you feel tension in your back and your neck? Or are you free from that? Stomach flip-flopping or clear? Pacing, picking, clicking, any of those things that the body is doing or not doing are some of the clues. If we're in a state of discontent and we don't want to stay there, the idea is, well, thinking, feeling, behavior, it's a very simple concept. Certainly belief systems, and there's a whole other body of energy that goes into thinking, some of which, as you stated earlier, is not even our own. It mm-hmm. can just simply be, I'm tuning into that, and that's where I am right now. But let's just say, for sake of argument, that if you're aware of thinking, and it's an unpleasant, discontent, lower than neutral thought, mm-hmm. then that's where the awareness is. I have to change at that level. I have to shift. What is the distortion of truth that I'm operating in, that we were calling story earlier, mm-hmm. to just shift, to find the distortion? There's a word in my sentence. There's two yep. or three words in this concept here. It's not the whole thing doesn't have to get thrown out. Right. It's just find the part that doesn't fit. Seek that out. Write it down if you have to. Look at it a couple of times. Ask somebody else, does this sound true? And there's going to be a piece of it that's not true. And if you're willing to examine that piece of it and then switch it out to simply make it a true statement, it will actually feel differently mm-hmm. when you hear yourself say it the next time or you share it with your partner. It will absolutely feel different. And of course, you have to get good. You have to practice to get this down. But it's very liberating to live in a story-free... That might be... End of life, perhaps, master level.
Well, I don't know. I think because we made a distinction earlier that I think is very significant, and that is there is a difference between talking from experience, which is not story.
Right.
When you're talking from experience, there is an energetic connection that takes place. There's an emotional alignment that takes place that has tremendous impact because it's coming from a place of authenticity. It's coming from a real space within that individual. That's more of the aligned space, where I think that when it's in story, you're not in that space at all. But I also think that the other word that I surprised that you didn't use, that I think is key to unraveling story, is responsibility.
Mm.
I find working with clients that presenting it in a way that enables them to own
right.
their experience, to own whatever it is really an initial step, because once they own it, then they can change it. But
right.
until I say this to clients all the time, our job is, what we're doing is we're taking stuff that lives below the conscious threshold and bringing it to the conscious threshold so that you can look at it and say, is this serving me or not serving me?
Right.
Before it gets there, you don't know it's operating.
Right. Right. You might feel it.
You might feel
sure
it, but you're not conscious
is, yeah.
of what it
yeah.
is. Mm-hmm. So if you own it, if you take responsibility that, okay, if I create all of this, and people go, but I didn't create that, and I didn't create that, and I didn't create that. And I'm like, but why wouldn't you want to? Because as soon as you do, you can do something about it. If you own that you create, then you own that you are the contributing factor. And if you are the contributing factor, then the story that you're making is sourcing through you. So if it's sourcing through you, then you can stop and go, wait a second, why am I telling that story? Similar end result in that you stimulate the individual's thought process about, wow, why am I doing that? Instead of, they were doing it to me, that's why I feel this way. Why am I doing that? Why am I telling this story still? What was it serving me? There's the answer to the question. What is it serving? We tell the story because it creates a hook. We tell the story because it keeps us attached to a way of feeling and being that we think is safe.
Right.
Normal. Yeah. So what is it we need to do to alter that? Well, if you own your experience, then you have the ability to change it, alter it, t- tell a new story. There's all kinds of options that you have that you don't have if you don't own, if you're not in that ability to respond, if you're not in that. Part of that, too, I think, is when you can get to a point of that being comfortable in, and this is part of the evolution of consciousness, but getting into that observer space where you can live more in the observer, and that observer is detached more from the reactive personality. The observer is the one that sees everything as stuff, and everything is something in the field of awareness. It's just there's a mug, there's a jar, there's a lamp, there's a tree, there's an emotion, there's a thought. They're all objects in the field of our awareness. We've just been trained to react to thoughts and feelings, not the same way we react to trees. But when you become more of the observer in your own experience, you can have a relationship with the tree that you couldn't have before, because now you can experience the tree, where before you couldn't experience the tree.
Right.
Right? You can experience the emotion, but you don't have to be the emotion.
Mm-hmm.
You can experience the thought, but you don't have to be the thought. It's all objects in the field of your awareness. That begins the process, I think, of elevating those subconscious and unconscious ideas above the surface, because you're now no longer triggered with, they don't trigger.
Mm-hmm.
They don't cause you to go into retreat. They don't cause you to go into, fall back to the story, because you're now no longer afraid of the responsibility. You know, that the idea that how do I respond? And that's something to me that's absolutely, that to me was a profound change in paradigm, was when you can see responsibility literally as your ability to respond to what shows up in your life. That's all it is. It's owning it. It's like, that. This is my life. It showed up in my experience. So if it's here, it's for me. So what am I going to do with it? What do I want to do with it? Do I want to keep it? Or do I want to make a story about it? But typically, if you're, at least from my perspective, if you can come to that level of responsibility, you're no longer needing to create story.
Right. It's a couple of thoughts I have about how we come to write our stories. I don't remember when or who did the experiment, but it was a fairly robust study with regard to what we think. At least 500 to 1,000 people were involved in the study, and they were asked to record their thoughts for as long as they could tolerate, whether it was 5 minutes or 5 hours, and to either write them down, to record them, or in some way capture them. And then a panel of judges were assembled to evaluate, is this a positive thought or a negative thought? And gathering all of these thoughts up, the outcome was that between 70 to 80% of the thoughts were negative, whether they were a little bit negative or really negative, that they fell into that category, 70 to 80%. Huge freaking number.
That is huge.
So
number.
Left alone, 70 to 80% of the time, we will be thinking something more frowny face than happy face. That's a huge, huge number, a huge awareness.
Yeah.
There's another notion. It cannot be proven, but it cannot also be disproven, that there is a consciousness, and you alluded to it earlier, if somebody's having a bad experience and you're in there sphere of influence, you're gonna, it's just like, I won't do it, but if I farted right now, you'd smell it, you'd go, you'd know you didn't do it. There's only two of us in the room, so you'd figure out quickly who did it, but it would be unpleasant until it passed, right? Mm-hmm. Well, energy and thought works in a similar way. We really do have mirror neurons that tune into, and we do feel each other's stuff. So there's a body of growing evidence that with regard to this thing that we call self-deprecation or the inner critic, there are people on the planet now saying it's not an inner critic, it's a global critic. It's an energetic field that we're operating in, and this, it feels personal, because it's freaking watching us, and it was there, and it knew that you just did something that you're telling yourself, I fucking did it again, you dumbass. And it feels like I'm the only one who knows what I did, but so does everything around me that was there too, that was watching, and that was part of that. And we're able to tune into that. So this inner critic may not be an inner critic. It may be more of a common human experience that we're all having, but we think it's us.
Yeah, that's what I call mass consciousness. That's what when I use the term mass consciousness, that's what I refer to as that.
It's not pleasant. Global. And that could be where a big part of our downer stories are coming from.
I definitely would agree with that. I think that we had, to the degree that, yes, everybody on some level, in some degree, has experienced some form of emotional trauma about something, some incident, some thing, some events in their lives. But ultimately, the thing that keeps us, if it's all about energy, it's all got to come down to vibration.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're choosing to vibrate, the emotional tone scale is all about vibration. Joy is at the top of that scale, and apathy is at the bottom of that scale. And if you're in apathy, your vibration is so low and so slow that you can't get anywhere from there.
Right.
You're just... But if you're in joy, your vibration is a much different vibration. And I think that what I would talk with clients about all the time is that about doing the work. There's a part of the process that requires daily application, because mm-hmm. you're spinning your vibration, you're shifting your state, but then you've got to figure out how to maintain that. You've got to figure out how to keep that energy consistent. And that if you're not doing the work, then your path is like this, because you're good, you're bad, you're good, you're bad, you're good, you're bad, and you throw in a good every now and again, and you feel better, and then you stop doing it, and you go down. But so vibrationally, whenever we would do the sustainable state exercise to engage the breath, you start to spin the vibration. And in the beginning of the process, early on, there was a physical experience of separating from mass consciousness, where there was a clarity that would come, and you could feel the density of the energy, and that it was so important to do the work consistently every single day. Because this was tenuous,
mm-hmm.
and it was easy to kind of go back down in. And if you missed a day or two, you're right back into masking. And you're wondering why your brain is all fucked up, and you're wondering why you're having all these nasty thoughts all the time that you can't seem to deal with. And it's almost like nicotine addiction, in a sense, in that whenever you allow your vibration to come down, the intensity of that, the stark intensity of it, is so powerful that it's overwhelming, because it's such a dense energy that when you're used to being in a higher vibration and you let your vibration decrease because you're not focused in doing your work, it's hard. It's very it feels so much worse than it felt when you were living there full time, because it's such a stark difference when you energetically. But I think that's It's so remarkably profound to watch people feel and experience that for the first time, where they actually experience that more rare, I call it rarefied air, only because it's a less dense space.
Mm-hmm.
And once they're there and then they start to fall from that space, that's the first time that I think many get to that place of responsibility where they go, oh, I guess if I want to feel consistently better and not be tied to the story, I've got to keep my vibration up.
Right.
I've got to keep spinning. I've got to keep that core vibration at a much higher frequency, so that that's not constantly in my space.
Right.
And so, as we were talking about earlier, that idea that the duality, where the ego mind chatter and mm-hmm. the thought noise is all here, while you're recognizing that everything is good. In doing the work that shifts your vibration, this gets quieter and this gets clearer. And there's probably a point, I'm guessing, based on the stuff that I've read and the stories that I've heard, that there's a point somewhere where you overcome, you can overcome that, this piece of it, to the point that this goes away. But that's like a long way down the pike. I think it's a bit of an illusion to think that that goes away like that.
When I was studying controlled remote viewing, the pioneers that have been dedicated their lives to this since the 60s gave up on it trying to go away and just gave it something to do, mm-hmm. so that it wouldn't get in the way of the sensing mind doing the remote off-site viewing. And an example of that would be if we look at this cup. It's funny that this actually has the International Remote Viewers Association logo on it as my example. That's kind of funny, isn't it?
That's awesome.
We call this a cup. So that would be left brain, and it would be ego. And we do that so we can very quickly agree that that's a cup and move on. The right side of the mind doesn't know what a cup is. Mm-hmm. The right side of the mind might say cold, solid, black, protrusion, wet. Okay, and now you're it's like, and even some of those words are more left brain than mm-hmm. right brain. But it's interesting because I'm trying to describe my experience with it mm-hmm. rather than just give it a name and then assume that you're going to understand through your understanding of what a cup is what your experience might be with this object. So one of the things that we challenged ourselves to do was throughout the day dump nouns and only use adjectives to describe what it is that you're experiencing and looking at, and my gosh, did it slow everything down. But it brought you so much more in tune with what really is going on, that it was arduous and just grind was going on inside. But it was really fascinating. And that then allowed us to, in a mild trance-induced eyes-closed state, be able to get outside of the room or the building we were in and go have these out of non-local experiences that were amazingly descript. But you wouldn't, when you wound up, say, viewing a target site, you wouldn't say, I'm standing in front of a white house. You'd say, I believe that I'm upright and I feel grit, you know, so you do it with bare feet. And you'd kind of like, you'd use your senses instead of using, as soon as you used a noun, we knew that that was not what was actually showing up. That's the left brain jumping in there and going, I want to play, I can name that tune too. I got to play, I'm important, I got to be involved too, right? And so in that moment, as soon as a noun would show up, we'd have the person repeat the target number, and it's this really long, like 15-digit target number, and then say, okay, left brain, go try to figure out the secret code of what the target number means in association with this thing. And then left brain would go, okay, I can do that. It's a code, and it's over here doing this thing. And then you gently go back to, let's look at it from above. And you'd say, I have a sense that there's a good energy here. There's moisture in the air, and you're just describing your experience with the thing, and then you have somebody busily writing all of this down to reconstruct the experience back into a diagram or back into a picture form. And you would take your hand and just, what is it that you're experiencing? And you'd do this thing that we, like a scribble. Mm-hmm. But believe it or not, that scribble would be the dorsal fin on a killer whale. That you would, after an hour and a half of doing this thing, you would say, wow, I actually, right from the beginning, had first sight contact with this thing that I didn't know was a killer whale until the very end when you put it all the pieces back together again. Mm-hmm. It was unbelievably fascinating how that would work. But we gave up on trying to kill that chatter of the left brain by just letting it be that annoying fly mm-hmm. that's buzzing around the room. Laughing at it and going, okay, you can play too, but just try not to get in the way too much.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. I think I shared this with you. My personal experience with separating from nicotine, that it's my mission in life to present as little resistance as possible in every situation that I encounter. And part of that was this process of finding a non-resistant space. And so what I was doing, what I continue to do, and I've actually started applying it to other things, but every time my mind would come up with, I need a cigarette, you know.
My story.
Instead of resisting it, I would stop and I would actually enjoy the thought for a moment, and I'd say, yeah, we used to do that. And that was it. And every time I do it, the energy would dissipate. Because I would be in complete agreement with, yeah, we did. We used to do that. And now we're doing something else.
I like the idea of we.
Yeah,
I love that.
And it completely shifts the energy. Where it doesn't become story. There's no resistance there. And mm-hmm. It's made a huge difference. Because there's no battle going on. It's just, this is my intention, and I'm following my intention, and this energy is going this direction. And, yeah, this is part of that process. We did used to do that. You don't have to anymore. But, it's the ways through the stories. I mean, like you said, the first thing you have to be able to do is to identify that you have one. You know, I don't know if you have this experience. I find it fascinating sometimes when I'm, especially with somebody that I've worked with for a while, is they'll be in the throes of, we'll be talking about some subject that came up over the course of the week, and they'll be chattering away. And I'll be sitting there, and finally I'll have to go, you know what? I've heard one word that you've said in the last 10 minutes. The rest of it is just blah, 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 blah. But the word I heard was this. So tell me about that word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. Sure.
It always gets a chuckle because I'm not rude about it, but it's just, you know, I just go, you're wearing me out. You know, like inside, it's like, this story is getting so tired. How do we help this shift? And it's very funny because it's, once they get it, once somebody gets that idea of creating story,
mm-hmm.
Because we do it with everything.
Yep, we do.
Everything. I mean, I'll get a phone call and I'm like, that's really great. That's just a whole bunch of story that has no relativity to what's going on with you. So let's talk about how you feel. You know, or the word or the phrase or the, you know, whatever that thing you mentioned earlier, the thing that you just know. There's mm-hmm. just a certain thing. Well, all of a sudden, we're having this good thing, and all of a sudden, it just went left. And
right.
Whoa, let's go back. What happened? But it's when you recognize it, when you can bring someone to the recognition of it, it's empowering. It's the beginning of a huge transformation.
Mm-hmm.
It's taking back so much of your life from all the places that you've left pieces of yourself.
Yeah.
You know, which I think is the most extraordinary thing in the world to watch happen. People start taking back pieces of themselves, and suddenly they're like, wow, I don't have to be that anymore. I don't have to feel that way anymore. I don't have to do that anymore. I don't have, you know. Right. Or conversely, oh, I can do this.
Right. Right. You had talked about responsibility 20 minutes ago or so. And owning what's happening, what's showing up. And I thought it might be interesting to talk for a moment some of the specifics of what that might look like. So for me, in working with people, switching from, you know, the classic you statements to I statements. So instead of you make me feel this way, or you make me angry, or you do this all the time, to own that by saying, I'm choosing to feel angry when this shows up, when you present yourself to me this way. That's owning it. Now, mm-hmm. I'm realizing that it's only me who can decide how I'm going to feel. Nobody has a magic wand. Nobody can make me feel anything.
Right.
That's owning it. And my goodness, do we like to give up ownership. Just, it shows up everywhere. And so that's a wonderful tool to begin to just shift into the I choose instead of you make. You make me, I choose to. Hugely different. Hugely different. That would be a nice thing for folks to be able to take away from our podcast. It's like, mm-hmm. hey, we got a couple of tools tonight we can play around with.
Yeah, well, and it changes, I mean, that radically changes how you interact with pretty much everything when you can start to take that ownership.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not, well, one, you have to automatically begin to shift out of victim mentality. Because if you own it, then you can't be, you're being a victim to yourself, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it could, but I don't know how you would be able to connect the dots in the same way.
Huh. I wanted to share a couple of stories. Since we've been talking about story, oftentimes you mentioned the gentleman in the beginning that had this disingenuous two-position issue, and then the red ball in the car and all that. I've been thinking about a couple of people that I've worked with over the years that have some really amazing stories that they're really, really still, after almost 5 years of working with them, it's like it's almost down in their DNA level trying to dislodge them from those stories. In this one instance, I can think of a woman who was molested by her mother and her mother's girlfriend, and it went on for some time. And then there were other women brought into her life that also were able to indulge in sexual improprieties with her because she was a minor. And when she didn't cooperate, according to her story, which was substantiated by her husband that apparently had known her as a kid and they have a really, you know, long history together, the girl as a teenager was made to sleep under the porch with the dogs and the snakes and the bugs and the rats and everything else. And you know, that sounds like, oh my gosh, how awful is that? And then there were some physical abuses, some broken legs and other broken bones, and some instances with some men that came into her life that were also abusive. So her story is, I have no boundaries. Anybody can do anything they want to me, was her core story. Because guess what? That was her experience. So from her experience, she developed her story. Now, as an adult woman, she's now 40, and the most strange things show up in her life because she's still operating with that story.
Mm-hmm.
She'll go to the car wash and expect to pay $15 for her car to get washed and will be given a bill for $40. And she's like, what's this? And like, it's like, I'm thinking, I've never had that experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she goes to a hotel room to stay for two nights, and halfway through the stay, the hotel manager says, you need to change rooms. And it's like, I've never had that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And just one case after the next, after the next, after the next of anybody can do anything they want to me, and I just have to roll with it and go with it, or I'm going to have to sleep, there's going to be hell to pay. Sleep under the, you know, get scared, watch rats crawl around all night long, whatever, get bit, you know, all these different things that she says that she experienced. Husband, not necessarily abusive, but pretty much does whatever he wants, and she goes along with it. And it's absolutely fascinating that, and as I've tried to tell her, it's okay for you to have your desire. So she wanted to buy a new car, and her husband always made all the decisions on what kind of vehicles we drive, and she went and bought the car she wanted. She had a job and had her money, and there was no reason that she couldn't, and it wasn't going to bankrupt them or anything. So she did that, and my goodness, did she get hell from everybody her husband, the in-laws, the outlaws, everybody showed up and told her, you know, how selfish she was and how it was just like, wow. Oh my gosh. Yeah, it's like everywhere. It's just showing up everywhere in her life. But little by little, we're talking like 5 years of work now, she is doing these small behavioral changes to see that I do have a voice, I can set boundaries, I don't have to be a victim. But that is one deeply, deeply embedded story. And there's another gentleman I can think of that his father said, you'll never amount to anything, you can't focus and concentrate, and although he became an engineer, he bounced from job to job, and those things were written in his evals, you know, can't focus and concentrate, and you're brilliant, but you're not a team player, and you'll probably never amount to anything. It's almost like those tapes that he heard from dad showed up in his annual reviews. It just kept showing up all over the place. And today, he stopped working and went to take care of his aging parents who died and inherited their home and everything, and that estate is now gone. I mean, he never went back to work, and that money is gone, and he's now in this position of, I've got to go back to work again. And so he's tried various ways of getting income, and he's educated to the point where, you know, a $20 an hour job at Lowe's wouldn't hold his attention, and he just couldn't do that. So his plan now is, when I run out of money, I'm going to eat a bullet. And that will be like the ultimate end of the story. He will have lived his story. I'll never amount to anything. Wow. And he's like, and we're talking like, he says April, May, June, he'll be out of money. So I have between April, May, and June to either get to watch him live his story and go, okay, it's his life. He gets to do what he wants with it, or help him try to change a little bit more of his story. But he's complicated that by being in a relationship where his girlfriend writes, but not well enough to get paid for it. And she has a developmentally disabled child that he's taking care of. And they have a whole bunch of dogs. And he's just writing checks. And it's only outgo. There's no income. And it's like that ship, you can just, each time he comes in, you can see it. It's just sinking lower in the water. And there isn't even an opportunity for him to abandon ship and get in the life raft and start rowing to shore. There's like nowhere to go. So we've talked about, well, why don't you go to Costa Rica? Okay, you can live down there for $5,000 a year. You could be a bartender and do just fine. There's a lot of expats down there. So he's kind of kicking that idea around. But yeah, it's fascinating how people are just absolutely stuck to their stories.
Yeah, those deeply entrenched ones are quite fascinating, because they're just as, they've built a cage, basically, and don't see any other way out of the cage.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it makes for interesting conjecture about what people choose to come here to do.
Yes, it does.
In when you see somebody like that that's built such a strong reinforced cage in their experience, because they had experience, but it's still the cage of their own creation. When they can't get past it, when they can't and don't desire to get past it, if that's not what their purpose was this time, solely and specifically.
Could have been. Yeah, that's not for me to judge.
Yeah, no. And just, it was more rumination and just curiosity. Because as you were talking, you know, as you were sharing the stories and listening, and I'm just looking for where's the gap in the energy? There's always a gap somewhere. There's always a path somewhere. And you go, wow, they have gone out of their way to just cement that shit down.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Nope. This is my story, and I'm living it, and that's the way it is. Holy cow. Because there has to be, I mean, I think that's one of the things that's so important in recognizing how to undo the story, is you have to be willing to see the story. You have to be willing to acknowledge that it exists, that it's hampering your experience, that it's keeping you from thriving.
Right.
And not just from lip service. You know, I mean, not the lip service to it, but the actual, you know, the genuine desire to create change. You know, what's your experience of them as far as their desire for change in their experience?
It's lip service.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not... So the payoff is obviously more satisfying than change.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever the payoff is for being there.
Well, they got used to living in that place. And
yeah. So is there apparently no... The story is so strong that there's no bottom? There's no... When I say bottom, I mean... it seems that with most, there is a point where... It was okay to this point, and then when it crossed this threshold, it was no longer tolerable, or it was no longer... It was like something about the threshold stimulated a desire for change. Like, I could deal with the pain at this level, but when the pain went to from an 8 to a 9,
mm-hmm.
I couldn't anymore, mm-hmm. and there's the gap. You know, and so there's a desire... There's enough of a desire just from going from an 8 to a 9 that creates a gap that you can... potentially get in and you know, pull some threads and things, but when they don't create any gaps, like, you kind of go, wow, that's so interesting. why would one choose that and just hold on to it with
everything?
Yep. And yeah, because then their whole identity is built in that, from that story.
In 25 years, I've had two patients take it all the way to the end. And they both happened within about 6 months of each other.
Mm.
And that was probably 10 to 15 years ago. And it made me want to discontinue my line of work because I had worked with both of them for about 5 or 6 years and had, you know, care and compassion and concern for them. And, you know, my story was I failed them. You know, I wasn't a good enough therapist. And the reality was that, you know, both their families at a later time said, if anything, you kept them here an additional 5 years and they had five more smiles or five more birthdays or something that was part of that. The first guy that took his life just... You know, was molested as a kid, and again grew up thinking I'll never amount to anything. Became an addict, got married, got divorced, moved back home with his parents, ended up using nicotine patches put all over his body, and downed a bunch of alcohol at the same time on his parents' anniversary in their bed. So they went to go celebrate their anniversary. They come home to continue celebrating their anniversary, turn on the lights, open the covers, dead son in the bed. A little bit passive aggressive there.
Good
just,
Lord.
Just a little bit.
Jeez.
The other gentleman I was working with, mediocre, moderate schizophrenia, several suicide attempts in the past, but kind of like really not super serious, just serious enough, cries for help sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
He told me, my plan is I have these lawn gnomes, concrete lawn gnomes, and I'm going to tie them to my wrists, and I'm going to jump in my pool and pull them in with me, and they'll keep me at the bottom of my pool, and I'm going to drown. I said, man, your kids are going to find you, and that's going to leave a mark. You know, don't do that. Just go for a walk somewhere and never come back. If you're really committed to this, and I'm not saying that's the right answer, but I'm saying definitely don't do that. Don't do that. So, and I said, and you know that since you've told me that, and you have lawn gnomes, and you have a plan, and you have ropes, you have the means to do this, I need to tell your wife, I need to tell somebody that this is going on. So I call his wife, who I also had worked with, and she goes, Jeff, he does this all the time. Don't worry about it. We don't even have a swimming pool. Week later, she calls. He did it. He did it. We found him in the bottom of the pool. And I'm like, what? You told me you didn't have a pool. And I get the big silence thing at that moment. And you know, I was really angry because, I mean, she flat out lied to me about the whole thing. But she had lived with this guy. They'd been married 25, 30 years. It was up and down, in and out, left and right. And they just both got to the point where they agreed, we're done. And this is your way out of here.
Wow.
And she went along with it. Fascinating. So he was stuck to his story that there's no hope for me. It'll always be this way. I'm no good. I'm better off dead than alive. I'm more valuable with insurance and all that sort of thing. And stories. Those are stories.
Yeah. Serious stories.
But isn't it?
It upsets people sometimes when you confront them with their stories. It upsets a lot of people that it's just a freaking story. It's not real. It's like my pain, you know, the pain thing. It hurt because I thought it did, and it stopped hurting because I no longer thought it needed to hurt, or it certainly didn't compare to the time before.
It didn't need to interfere, yeah. Yeah.
Well, speaking of stories, should we start wrapping this story up? I'm hoping that, because this, as you mentioned in the beginning, Jim, that this topic, you know, it's worldwide, it's applicable to every person who's ever walked the planet. And I'm hoping that we've kind of just scratched the surface, and as we stay open to what the universe would want us to talk about more and use more examples. I love tying, you know, we're really good at the concepts and the principles, mm-hmm. and sometimes when we can use those personal stories that you're awesome about, and then the anecdotal things, I think that brings a nice complete picture to what we're trying to share. So maybe the universe can put it on our hearts and minds to hear some more, maybe not the really deep ones like I shared, but mm-hmm. I'm hoping that that's just a tiny, tiny, tiny percent of anybody that would be listening to this message. That it might be more the everyday kinds of stories that we could help people shift out of. So those are my thoughts, folks.
Yeah. Yeah, we had, I think, some one of the things that I think is important to reiterate as we close this is the recognition of the difference between experience and story, and that our experiences are very valuable and critical to our own evolution, and that every experience we have is designed to propel us and move us in the direction of what we're looking for in this life experience, regardless of how we assess that, positively or negatively. But that's where story comes in.
Mm-hmm.
When you can have an experience, when you can move through an experience and see it for the experience that it is without attributing story to it, then it becomes the thing that catapults and moves your energy and consciousness forward. It's when we decide that we have to move out of that sphere, when we go from talking about our experience to talking about the story of our experience, that's where it gets muddy.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to clarify that because I was hearing in my head these idea that a lot of people have experiences, and those experiences are traumatic experiences. And just because they're traumatic simply means that there was an emotional impact that occurred.
Yep.
And you can observe that. You can not be the victim to that experience by contributing a story to it.
Mm-hmm.
And by virtue of doing that, you honor the event for what it served in your experience, but then it's no longer anything other than an event that served your experience. And you can always look into your experience. If you can tell a story about your experience that doesn't alter your energy, then you're not telling a story. You're talking about experience.
Right.
When it begins to alter your emotional state, you're no longer in experience, you're now in story.
That's really awesome. Way to put that. Well, shall we call it a wrap then?
That's awesome.
All righty.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Adventures in Truth Podcast. If you would like to listen to more or to explore all our offerings, visit us on the web at www.adventuresintruthpodcast.com. We also offer video versions of our podcast. Visit our page on YouTube at Adventures in Truth Podcast. We would love to hear from you. Like, connect, and follow with us on Facebook. Want to book us for your next podcast or to speak at your event? Head over to our webpage at www.adventuresintruthpodcast.com at the bottom of the page and send us a note. Thank you so much for listening. We look forward to seeing you again at Adventures in Truth Podcast.